From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, it's the future. Or at least the future of nanotechnology.
In the future, you can imagine you use these tiny machines, you get a scratch in your car, light comes in, it opens, it pops open, and it repairs itself. I think these kind of things, these self-repairing materials, for instance, might come within 10, 20 years from now.
Later, an historical view of World War II and the Cold War from a man who spent 6 years in an East German Stasi prison.
Plus, how the California wildfires are affecting the Napa Valley wine industry.
And why the words of Shakespeare have great therapeutic value for military veterans.
In Shakespeare, the rule of thumb is that what people say is what they're really feeling, so the feelings are really out there. And then it's this beautiful, big, poetic language that just holds all of this emotion.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Yesterday on the show, we spoke with two scientists who study very, very small things, things like neutrinos. Our first guest today is the 2016 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry for his work on very, very small things, like nano-sized motors.
Dr. Ben Feringa is a professor of chemistry at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He was here last month to give the Nobel lecture at UW-Milwaukee, and he joined us in the studio to talk more about his work. Dr. Feringa, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
If you and I sat next to each other on a plane and I asked you what you did, what would you tell me?
Okay, I am a chemist and I teach at the university. So I'm a professor of chemistry. And so we teach the basics of chemistry, but with our students, of course, we also do research and try to design new molecules, new materials, think about the new chemical processes for the future, how we make fuels, how we make plastics, how we make pharmaceuticals. This is the kind of things we do in the laboratory. And in particularly, we like to look at the future, what we cannot do today, but what we will be able to do tomorrow. How to make, for instance, sustainable chemical processes that cost low energy, need to make in a better way, make the materials for the future that we use in our daily lives.
So what kind of chemical processes are you trying to make better?
For instance, we make processes for a chemical industry, as I mentioned before. For instance, how to make a pharmaceutical that usually takes a lot of chemical steps, a lot of processes. And we try to develop processes that need less material, that do it at lower temperatures, less energy, and in a much better way. So faster, cleaner. That's the way we try to do that. We often work also together with industry in this respect.
One of the things that you specialize in is the nanotechnology, the very, very, very small, building those tiny things that help all of those processes happen.
Yes.
And so I think most of us, when we think of nanotechnology, we think of Star Trek.
Right.
Or we think
right.
of science fiction. This is actually happening.
Yes, it's a bit of science fiction. First of all, nano is 1,000 times smaller than micro that you use in micro technology. So nano is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, really tiny, the level of molecules, like the molecules in your body. And so we design these nano systems, and in particularly what we try to do is to build molecular motors. So we built the world's first rotary motor, the size of 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, 1 nanometer in size. Now think about motors, machines in your factories, in your cars, your planes, they are everywhere to the macro scale, the world around us. In your body, it's full of motors and machines that make it possible that we can lift our arm, that we can see each other, that we can talk, that things go in and out of the cells in our body. But we as chemists, so far, we're not very good in making things move. And now, for the first time, we can make these tiny motors and tiny machines at the scale of molecules, nanometer size. So this will be the nanotechnology of the future.
So is the idea that you can use these tiny rotary motors to, say, deliver a drug in a way that we can't now?
Yeah, for instance, it's a bit of science fiction. You mentioned it already. But indeed, when we look at this Asimov story, tiny robots, submarines, that go in your blood veins and deliver a drug, a pharmaceutical, or detect a tumor cell, for instance, or do a repair in your body. I think this is still with science fiction. But once you know how to make a motor, how to make things moving at the nanoscale, you can imagine that in 40, 50 years from now, the surgeons, the doctors will inject these tiny robots in your blood vein and they will go to deliver the drug or to search for a defect cell or do a repair. But there are many other applications. Think about when you cut your finger, yeah, it repairs itself. Now, if you have a scratch in your car, you usually go to the garage and then they have to polish it again, etc. But in the future, you can imagine you use these tiny machines. You get a scratch in your car, light comes in, it opens, it pops open, and it repairs itself. I think these kind of things, these self-repairing materials, for instance, might come within 10, 20 years from now.
That soon?
I think so.
Yeah, because that seems very much the province of science fiction for us, I think.
It is. But smart materials, responsive materials, you know, that will come. And biomedical applications. At the moment, we work, for instance, and I was discussing this at the university yesterday, we think about making smart pharmaceuticals, smart drugs. So imagine you take a pill. It's in principle, it's active everywhere in the body, but you hope it goes for where there is something wrong, an infection or so. But what we try to do is to make pills that you can switch on and off with light. So it's normally off. It doesn't be harmful to other parts of the body. You put a lamp on a specific spot and say you have somewhere an infection. You switch on the lamp, you switch on the drug, the pharmaceutical, and it does its job precisely there where it is needed and not anywhere else. That's a bit of a dream scenario. We have done the first test in the laboratories with cells. We try now to go to the next step, and hopefully we get to the clinic in the future.
And how long do you think it will be before that reality happens, where we can go to the doctor and say, you know, my heart needs something, we'll do targeted.
It is, of course, a bit of a dream scenario, and you know it takes a long time. A new pharmaceutical, it usually takes 10, 12 years and a lot of money to develop it because you have to go through all these clinical tests, etc. We are at a very early stage. This is very fundamental research, trying to do things in a very different way. That might take another 20 years before we reach that stage because there are many hurdles to take, and that's what we work on.
Not the least money.
And, of course, you need money. I mean, fundamental science, working with a team of scientists, students, graduate students, postdocs, to work on these kind of problems, it's very demanding. It needs lots of different expertises. We try to bring together, build these teams, also to work together maybe with companies and so, to see if we can develop this further. But it needs, indeed, money, because otherwise, if we don't have grants, if we don't have the facilities to do this, because it's complicated research and it takes indeed several years to get to the stage where it can be applied. That needs a solid funding basis, and that is really important to bring us forward to the future.
One of the other things I think it needs is an understanding from the general populace that this kind of scientific research, A, is important, and B, as you say, takes time. It's not instant gratification.
No, let me take an example. Your iPhone, your smartphone. You cannot imagine, at least my children cannot, who are students, cannot imagine that there was a world without smartphones. Now, these were introduced 10 years ago or so. It has completely changed our world, the way we communicate, etc. The components for these smartphones were discovered by chemists and physics based on fundamental research, the transistors, the display materials for your screens, in the 40s and 50s of the past century. It took 50 years to bring it to the stage that we can build a smartphone, an iPhone. Now it's common, but it might take time from the fundamental discoveries in the laboratories, at the universities, at the research institutes, to bring it to the applications for our daily life. And it will change life, as we have seen with our smartphones. We cannot deny that. It completely changed our lives.
And so what do you think needs to be done to encourage people, maybe not to become chemists like you, but to support that kind of research?
Yeah, I think it is really important that in society we understand how important it is we educate our young people, because they will shape our society in 20, 30 years from now. That's prime importance. Invest in your youth, the education. And second, of course, invest then in science and and development, because it's not only the science, it's also the trajectory afterwards, you know, spin-off companies like you see here at the University of, in Milwaukee, the University of Wisconsin, where you have small spin-off companies, and they will bring it forward. New industries that will come with these solutions, like, for instance, smart drugs, new materials that repair themselves, better processes for the industry that cost less energy, less materials, and are more sustainable. And I think these kind of investments will pay off, because they will shape how we will have our society in the future. What kind of materials do we have? How are we going to drive in our cars? Do we have better batteries so that we drive electric cars and make it more sustainable? This is, I think, really important that we invest now in our future.
You won the Nobel Prize in chemistry last year. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
In addition to the prize itself and the honor that that confers on you and your research, what does that do going forward? Do you take that honor and say, okay, look, we're doing something really important, you know, gather investment for this?
Yeah, of course, we try to pursue our science and research on these tiny motors and machines and this nanotechnology in general. This is now spreading out. There is a lot of development ongoing in the research institutes around the world. And so I'm strongly advocating that. And I'm also doing research myself, of course, with my team. But what is also very important is that I go out and try to convince the politicians, the public, the schools, the kids, the teachers, how important it is to invest, you know, in education and science. So I take time not only to teach at the university and to do research, but also I go to elementary schools, I go to high schools, I give presentations for teachers and for students to emphasize the importance of education, of research, to think beyond our current borders and to make a better world. I see that as an important duty to bring the message forward, why this is so important for our future. And it gives also a lot of pleasure, I must say. If this award, this Nobel Prize, helps a little bit to bring this message forward to politicians, to the general public, to the school kids and the teachers, I think that's part of I see it as part of my duty, you know, to give something back to society.
You are a very happy ambassador.
Thank you
yes.
so much.
Well, Dr. Feringa, I am so glad we were able to get you in the studio in your brief time here in Milwaukee. Best of luck with all of the research and all of your ambassador duties. It has been such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Ben Feringa is a professor of chemistry at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. He shared the 2016 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on nano-sized motors. He was in Milwaukee last month to give the Nobel Lecture at UW-Milwaukee.
We'll take a short break now and then hear the unique stories of two men with remarkable ties to the Cold War. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues here on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The current political climate in Washington, with its accusations of meddling by Russia in U.S. elections, has many hearkening back to Cold War days.
While the Cold War ended more than 20 years ago, its legacy is still fresh in the minds of two people I had a chance to speak with over the summer and in an appropriate place, the Cold War-themed Milwaukee restaurant, The Safe House.
I'm Warden Driscoll, and basically, I'm a former G2 United States Army intelligence operative, and my activity with the intelligence service is going back to the 1949, pretty early.
Well, my name is Francis Gary Powers, Jr. I am the founder and chairman emeritus for the Cold War Museum, and my interest in the Cold War stems from my family heritage. Dad was the U-2 pilot shot down over the former Soviet Union on May 1st of 1960. That ended up in the history books as the U-2 incident. And I am now helping to honor Cold War veterans, preserve Cold War history, and educate future generations about this time period, because the Cold War is over and kids today don't know anything about it.
The question I have that I think both of you can reflect on, Werner, you spent time in an East German prison in the course of what you were doing in the intelligence world. How much of your life today do you still reflect on the time, however many years ago that was, more than a half century ago?
Well, actually, after 6 years in captivity, it's a mark. It's a scar. Actually, you have scars on your skin. But if there is something like a scar on your soul, in your soul, medically, if there is such a thing, I don't know. But I would say I never seen a scar on the soul. But if there is such a thing, I think I still have it after so many years. Because that is something you will never, never disappear.
And for me, freedom is precious. It's something that many people take for granted. They don't understand what it's like to be free because they are free and they've never been in captivity. They've never had their freedom taken away from them. And so for Werner, having been in prison for 6 years, in a Stasi prison of all prisons, and my father to be incarcerated in a Soviet prison for almost 2 years, they have a much deeper appreciation of what it is to be free, as opposed to confined and limited.
We're sitting here, we're actually in the newsroom pub, but we're right next to the safe house, and the safe house is this restaurant that has all this Cold War memorabilia, and it's you know, one part museum, one part restaurant, and kind of one part curiosity, maybe is the way to put it. How do you view people's interest in that period? There are people that, many people that go to this restaurant, they probably go to the Cold War Museum, who have very little memory of that period. Do you think we treat that era with enough respect?
Definitely no. There's one thing leaking. And that is, of all the wars the United States ever had, the most important war is not even mentioned. This country can never ever been militarily occupied. Let's say, like, let's go back to World War II. The Germans and the Japanese, they could have never occupied this country militarily. It's impossible. But ideologically, that is where you can occupy this country. And then, let me put it this way. In other words, would we have lost the Cold War? Look at the flag over there in the corner, and look at the 50 stars. Now, would we have lost the Cold War? That flag would look totally different. You would not see the 50 little stars in there. What you would see in there would be 50 little hammer and sickles, because militarily, you can not occupy this country. And only, it's like a herd of sheep. Namely, the 95% of the people don't count at all. It's the 5% of the people and less who are able, capable to hijack the power and enforce their policy. And that's it. So therefore, the Cold War is the most important victory this country ever had. And it's not being taught, and we don't teach it in social science. There are no Cold War history teachers. We still talk about storming Iwo Jima and all the things. But they were all battles won. Thankfully, they were born, and no D-Day and whatever. But just think about it, if we would have lost the Cold War.
And I agree with Werner, for the most part, about Cold War history not being taught. But on my lectures around the country, I'm seeing a trending change, in that more universities are offering Cold War courses. More high schools are starting to teach Cold War more than just the last week of the semester. And that they're starting to interpret the Cold War based on the War on Terror. and how the Cold War transformed and transitioned from the Cold War between the Soviets and the Americans to an ambiguous war between enemies that don't have a quote-unquote country that they call home.
How do you feel when you see something like a prison door from a Stasi prison in a restaurant, and you see artifacts? You know, they're kind of kitschy artifacts, but these are real parts of that scar on your soul, if you will.
Well, this safe house has actually two dishes on the menu, on its menu. And one is the culinary dish which you eat, and then it has, they also serve history.
And for me, this is, well, for me, this is normal. I mean, my house has Cold War artifacts in it and has pictures on the walls. So this is my life. I live this, it's normal, I understand it, I see it, I know what it is. But for people who don't have a Cold War background or who are not knowledgeable of Cold War history, they come in and oftentimes they just are unaware of what's on the walls around them, how important the artifacts in the safe house are to preserving this Cold War history. There are pieces of the Berlin Wall. There's this Stasi prison door, an authentic Stasi prison door in Milwaukee.
and you're okay with French fries being served next to it?
Right. Oh, yes, most definitely. Because it's also the theme here. Espionage, James Bond, intrigue, KGB, CIA, the man from UNCLE. All of these themes throughout this restaurant keep that history alive. Now, some of it's Hollywood, but some of it is authentic, down-to-earth, real-life artifacts. And people who come in and see the signatures on the walls or the artifacts on the walls and take the time to show their children about it, they're doing them a service.
Well, and it's not only in the United States. Let me just tell you an actual fact from my friends, which I just heard from Berlin. A graduating class in the West German town of Cologne is being rewarded for the excellency in performing and getting the degree with a trip to Berlin. And there they are, the geniuses of the graduating class visiting the Brandenburg Gate. And there is one question asked by one of the graduates. And very humbly she asked that question. But there's one thing I don't quite understand. How could they build the Brandenburg Gate so close to the wall? Self-explanatory. Yeah. Well,
but then again, I think I have to explain a little bit because the listening audience may not understand the connotation here. The Brandenburg Gate is 150 years old or something
wow,
to that effect.
And it was done with the 18, Napoleon took the horses off 1870s or 17 something.
And I imagine there are a lot of people who think that the Berlin Wall was there 150 years ago.
So there we have, right? So basically it's not only going to, for our students, even the people. We were far away, removed from the Cold War, but the actual people over there can, I'm speechless.
Well, okay, so let me ask you a question, and I apologize for opening this can of worms, but given the place of you and your family in history, when you watch today the news that what is no longer the Soviet but is now the Russian government has attempted to have its influence on American politics, what goes through your mind?
It's very simple. Let me tell you that, very well explanatory. The Cold War started 1945, immediately after the end of World War II, and it ended in 1991. End of the subject matter. The Cold War won, ended. And all what you have today, I don't know how you're gonna label it, what it is. Maybe you can call it, if you want to and wish, you can call it the Cold War II. It's okay with me. But do not call it the continuation of the Cold War. It's a new war. Now, and if you make, specifically, if you are asking me, what is the today situation in the world? There is only one answer, which I have now as a military historian, not earning my degree on a University of Advanced Sciences, but you know, I learned history exactly there where the real leaders learned it, where Lenin learned it, where Stalin learned it, where Mao Zedong learned it, where the most of the Pandit Nehru learned it. They all learned military history in prison. And my answer for the problems of today, name whatever situation exists in the world. For me, it is nothing else but whatever we have in today's world is a failed U.S. foreign policy. End of the story.
Now, my take on the Russians currently, over the last year, trying to influence our presidential election is it's nothing new. On either side, back in 1960, Khrushchev is quoted as saying that he intentionally delayed the release of my father in order to prevent Nixon from winning and giving the election to Kennedy. In fact, Nixon blamed in part the U-2 incident to his defeat against Kennedy. So you jump up to today, and I look at all these newspaper articles that are going, and all the people that are so upset and crying foul that the Russians tried to influence our American election. And I laugh. Americans, the American government, has been influencing elections around the world from the beginning of the Cold War. But now that it's happening to us, oh no, foul, you can't do that, that's not right. Not realizing that we've been doing it all along. And I'm not saying that America's bad for doing that. We were trying to exert our foreign policies in other countries and making sure that communism didn't spread. They justified it that way. But now that it's happening to us, it's a taste of our own medicine.
This goes back to what you were saying about the occupation is an idea and not a physical thing.
The question of meddling would be, which I have not answered, but you can answer me exactly, who was meddling in Persia? You know what Persia is? Persia, ask the students and they wouldn't even know what Persia is, right? But ask them about Iran. Because that is somebody did some meddling, right? In a democratic elected Persia, wasn't that name Mossadegh? Whatever happened to that guy? Where did the Shah came from? I mean, that was some meddling. Maybe wasn't that meddling?
This really does seem to go back to what you were saying—the idea that the Soviet Union could never occupy physically the United States, but maybe this is a realization that what it really is all about is trying to occupy the thoughts and the spirit.
It's even so, and you know, and most people, and that is how little the public is aware of the Cold War. You know, today, just do it yourself. I mean, just go on any interstate, right? And you know, and ask anybody, why do we have an interstate? And they say, oh yeah, so we can go and see our grandparents faster in a certain time and in a faster way and things like that. And nobody really realizes that the biggest Cold War spending ever implemented in the United States is the interstate system, because Eisenhower, he knew how to win the war. He won the war once he entered the Autobahn. He knew that Mr. Adolf was done. It's a defense project. From time to time, no matter what it is, there's one stretch of a pretty long straight highway, interstate. What do you think what it is? These are the landing strip for future aircraft, which are only indicated on military maps.
Just in case there was ever a need and there was an invasion on American soil, the interstate system could then be turned into an air base to help fight off the enemy.
Right, and this is what's interesting about this. This is probably the most visible and yet least known legacy of the Cold War.
Very well said. The least known.
Let me thank both of you, Werner and Gary. Thanks so much, and best of luck to both of you in your work.
All right. Mitch, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Werner Uretzko is 85 years old. He was born in the disputed Upper Silesia region of Europe. He was recruited as an undercover political operative for the U.S. Army's G2 intelligence service, during which time he was captured by the East German Stasi and imprisoned for 6 years. Today, he lives in Illinois.
Francis Gary Powers Jr. is the son of Francis Gary Powers, the American U-2 pilot who was shot down over the Soviet Union in 1960. He is the founder and chairman emeritus for the Cold War Museum in Warrenton, Virginia. We spoke with Uretzko and Powers at the Safe House Restaurant in Milwaukee, and you can read more about both of them at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break now, and then contributor Ray Pfister joins us to talk about how the recent wildfires in California have affected that region's huge wine industry. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. At last report from the Interagency Fire Center, two significant wildfires are continuing to burn in California. They have already charred more than 111,000 acres, and while the threat to life and property is dying down, the effects of California's wildfire season this year will not soon be forgotten.
The fires killed people and had a potentially devastating effect on the Napa Valley region, where many of the country's finest wines are produced from grapes that are grown there. But Lake Effect contributor Ray Pfister joins me now and says the wineries are still open for business.
If you go to any winery's site right now, you're going to hear everybody saying, or you're going to see everybody saying, please come here. This is the time to come. Napa and Sonoma needs the support. They want visitors to come. Wineries certainly have had some damage. There's a couple that did burn down, in particular Ray Signorello, who is an old friend of ours as well as a winemaker we've interviewed a couple of times. His winery burnt to the ground. Another one called White Rock had severe damage. We had originally thought it had burned to the ground, but last I heard that they protected most of it in their caves, most of the wines. I don't know about the physical property where they're at. It's a great winery, too. So a lot of damage. One winery that we were at in April called Paradise Ridge. I'll never forget this place. I'd never been there. We got there, had a stunning view on the ridge of a mountain. On the side, you could see all of Sonoma. We were there for the barrel auction in April. Probably even talked about it with you. And I saw the after pictures, and all it was a slab. It was just so hard to look at it and imagine what these people lost.
The other thing, too, is you think about the loss of the vines, how long it takes for grapevines to get to the point where they're producing.
Well, see, now that's an interesting point. Many of the vines weren't damaged. Some were, some weren't. Vines themselves present almost a firewall to some degree because of the way they're made, the way they lay out. They don't catch fire easily because they are very green. And fires, more often than not, seem to stop right at the edge of many vineyards, not all of them. And I can't tell you what vineyards were damaged, but it's helped in many ways. I was supposed to be there. I was supposed to fly out on Wednesday. This was my regular trip for this time of year. And I was talking to everybody on Tuesday that I had contact with, plus interviews I had lined up for the podcast. And everybody was just saying, you know, you can't go anywhere. You can't get anywhere. I usually stay in the city of Napa with a winemaker friend of mine. And he was okay, come along, but everything was just too close for comfort. So I just decided I'd put it off. So I'll be going out there on November 15th.
Does the smoke and all of that, is that going to affect the wines in the future, the grapes, you know, as they are growing now?
Well, the grapes have mostly been harvested. Okay. In Napa and in Sonoma, they say about 90% as of a week ago was harvested. So I'm going to assume pretty much everything is harvested by now. I was talking to my friend Henrik Paulsen. He's the winemaker for Acumen Wines, which is up on Soda Canyon Road, for those folks who know Napa, up in the mountaintop. And they were testing extensively for smoke taint. Smoke taint, I imagine everybody understands, pretty obviously smoke gets on the grapes, and it taints the flavor of the wine, which is a very bad thing. They're having no detection of it for that particular vineyard right now. All the wineries are checking that. Again, so many grapes were already harvested before the fires got really bad that they were safe. And they also talked about the idea of when Many of these grapes are inside the barrels. The CO2 that's in the barrels will push out the smoke taint, so theoretically not affect the juice as it ferments. It all depends. It'll be interesting to see the reviews for this particular vintage, but it's going to be certainly an affected vintage, and it might be down a bit from people who lost their grapes. The real loss came really in Santa Rosa. So many houses, I mean, neighborhoods completely destroyed. I saw pictures. It looked like Hiroshima.
And so looking ahead to next year and the year after, are we likely to see effects, maybe just volume effects, but effects in general from the fires?
You'll probably see some higher prices, sure, just because production costs go up. It's not raising prices for any reason other than simply production, maybe making up for what's lost. Again, I can't tell you how many vineyards have been directly burned. Most of the wineries that I am associated with lost no vineyards. So I think, if anything, it's to be determined right now. But the biggest cry I'm hearing from Napa, other than there are so many charities, you can go to our website or any other website out there and check them out, where you can see where you can donate if you'd like. But the wineries are saying, please come here, come visit. Tourism's open. The valley's open, both valleys. Come visit us, and that's the best way you can help us. And the other thing, too, a lot of wineries have issued special wines that are not inexpensive, that a good portion of those funds for those wines are going to the recovery effort in the valleys.
So we haven't lost the industry.
Oh, heck no. But certainly took it to the, you know, to the stomach real bad.
Yeah.
And more than anything, it was frightening. Again, my friend Henrik, living in the city of Napa. Napa's a small town, but, you know, it's a reasonable size. It came close. And to think about that, I mean, he had his suitcase packed. That's a very frightening thought. I mean, think of it, your own home, having to think of leaving everything behind. I mean, you know, you have cats, you have personal items, people who lost everything. It's unbearable.
Well, on happier news, you also went to Italy.
I did.
And I'm very, very envious, and I don't like you. I just want to say that. You know, going right on the record for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So obviously you went for wine and food. Do talk about the wine.
This was the Asti DOCG, which is the group that controls the Asti winemakers in that region, who invited me along with 14 other writers, some sommeliers, this whole group to come there to visit, to go to 10 different wineries, to taste their wines, to try their food, to see their property, and to meet the owners.
So it was a very, very difficult assignment.
It was hard. It was difficult. You know, you had to sit on an airplane, then you had to sit on a bus, and then you had to go drink wine and eat food.
All of that rich food.
That was very hard.
Yeah.
Boy, the food. Oh, my God, the food.
I can eat my way through Italy.
Easily.
There's just no question. So tell us, for those of us who are geographically challenged, where is this region in Italy?
This is in the northwestern part of the country. This was Piedmont, the Piedmont region, which is very close to Switzerland, which was the neat part of coming back while we're riding on our bus to Milan, which is where we flew in and out of, to see the Alps. We were like kids with our noses up against the left side of the bus looking at these things, just going, wow.
Yeah, they're big.
They're very big.
They're big.
And they're right there, and they're just all the way along there. So the wineries were extraordinary. The wines, these were primarily Asti, which were sweeter wines. They also had the Asti Secco, which is a drier version there, but not terribly drier. Lower in alcohol, sparkling wines, very tasty. And we also tried some Barolos. We did some Barberas. And just amazing the focus that these folks have on their wines. It is complete and utter passion.
And so are there certain types of wines that you had not really spent any time with before that you said, I'm going to add this to my collection?
Well, I've always liked Barolo, and I've been a Barbera lover for a very long time. But the Asti Secco is new. Again, it's a drier version, not a sweet version of this sparkling wine. And that surprised me. Part of this idea going there was to have a completely open mind, to try these wines and not put my nose in the air about sweet wines, because they're very inexpensive. And this is what Italians drank for years and years and years before the high-end industry grew. And, I found them real good. And, again, the pairing with food was what made the difference.
So what did you pair them, or what did they pair them with?
Oh, gosh, gnocchi. Lots of gnocchi.
Okay. So rich, hearty gnocchi with some sweet wine.
Yeah, that, and there was this little itty-bitty, kind of looked like ravioli. It had a name, I can't remember the name of it, but very tiny raviolis with beef inside them and just a sparse amount of sauce. I could go on for days. It was really good.
We don't tend to think of sweet wines with hearty food, but it sounds like it was a really good mix.
It was a very good mix. These are not aperitifs. These are wines that are meant to go with food. In Europe, in general, and specifically in Italy, wine is food, and that's part of the daily meal. That's what they drank instead of water or whatever.
So you're going to go back?
I'm on the way right now. Just kidding. Hopefully.
You already have a ticket.
Hopefully we're going back next year, I hope. But they were extraordinary people. So nice, so friendly, and so much fun and great sense of humor.
Ray Pfister, always great to talk with you.
Bonnie, thanks very much.
Ray Pfister owns Fifth Floor Recording Studio in Milwaukee, produces the podcast Life Between the Vines, and is a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can find more coverage of the California wildfires and more at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break, and then Othello gets a unique staging by a group of Milwaukee veterans. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Othello is one of Shakespeare's most military plays. The tragic story of the betrayed general is one of the most gripping plays in the English language. A production opening tonight at Next Act Theater features some veteran actors in the roles Shakespeare created. But in this case, we mean the actors are all veterans, not of the stage, but of the U.S. Armed Forces. Lake Effect's Bonnie North picks up the story.
On that, where you give him his orders.
In a neon-lit rehearsal room in the basement of the UW Milwaukee Theater Building, a troupe of actors is blocking a scene from Othello.
The Turk, with the most mighty preparation,
makes for Cyprus.
Othello.
The fortitude of this place is best known to you.
As Shakespeare's words fill the room, you begin to notice the unit patches on the jackets, the pins on the hats. And then there's the unmistakable carriage of people who at one time stood at attention and parade rest in real life.
Michael A. Keppert, 21 Bravo, formerly 12 Bravo Company.
Carissa DiPietro, United States Army, and I was a 71 Lee.
Ronnie Graham, a U.S. Navy aviation support equip, but my last 3 years I was TA.
June Preston, I'm Army wife, spouse.
Tim Schleiss, served from 1978 to 2003, 19 kilo.
My name is Jeff Peterson, boatswain's mate and a solar technician, and I served during the tail end of Vietnam.
Right there on your line,
I do undertake these present wars against the Ottomites, humbly bending to your state.
The reason these veterans and this military spouse are in this rehearsal room is because of the Feast of Crispian, Shakespeare with Veterans. It's the brainchild of trained actors and directors Nancy Smith Watson, Bill Watson, and Jim Tassie. They wanted to make a difference in the lives of post-deployed vets who Smith Watson says are often suffering.
A lot of the veterans that we work with have issues with PTS, so a big piece of that is that their emotions are just cut off, their feelings are just cut off.
But how does speaking Shakespeare help these actors acknowledge difficult feelings? Military spouse June Preston, who plays Amelia, says it's the words.
The words that he wrote help bring forth the emotion that you actually do feel about the situation. It's a powerful thing. You know, it's just a really powerful tool for that.
Smith Watson agrees.
In Shakespeare, the rule of thumb is that what people say is what they're really feeling. So the feelings are really out there. And then it's this beautiful, big, poetic language that just holds all of this emotion.
Ere I would say, I would drown myself for the love of a guinea hen, I would change my humanity with a baboon.
Well, what must I do? I confess,
it is my shame to be so fond, but it is not in my virtue to...
Army vet Tim Schleiss is June Preston's husband, and he's one of the actors playing Iago. He says he wasn't initially sold on trying his hand at acting, but they had reached the end of the line as a couple, and something had to change.
For me, it was my last chance. I was very low in a very dark place, so I had to take a chance. When I got there, I realized I was in a place where I felt safe. I was with people who felt the same things I was feeling, experienced the same things I experienced. So for the first time in a very long time, I felt that I was in a safe environment.
June chimes in.
That was a year ago. Came home in a different mood. something that finally sort of helped him.
Come, man, be a man. Drown myself, drown cats and blind puppies.
Finding a safe place to be who they are and where they can express who they might want to become is the common thread these veterans share. Army vet Carissa DiPietro, who's playing Desdemona, says being part of Feast of Crispian saved her life.
I actually have a relationship with my children. I have a relationship with my husband. Like, I have dreams for the future. I never thought I'd live to 40. I always thought I would have committed suicide by now. And now I'm 40. And it's like, oh my goodness, look at this whole world ahead of me. I have dreams. I want to buy an RV and just travel. And I didn't have those dreams 3 years ago. I didn't even think I'd be alive today.
Despite the now obvious results, Nancy Smith Watson says that when Feast of Crispian first approached the VA, there was some initial skepticism.
When we first started this work, some of the mental health people at the VA said, oh, what are you going to do when they get really, really mad? And we said, oh, we're going to applaud and we're going to put them, you know, we're going to put them on the lines and let them use the lines of Shakespeare to go to those places. And then they're going to get applause afterwards.
Navy vet Jeff Peterson has participated in Feast of Crispian events from the beginning in 2013.
I attend different groups at the VA. This is the best therapeutic, non-therapeutic group.
And Smith Watson is quick to agree that while the work can be therapeutic for the actor veterans, she and her two colleagues are not therapists, but actors themselves.
The thing about acting is that our skills are in emotions. And in therapy, there's positive emotions and there's negative emotions, and they spend a lot of time managing their emotions. And in acting, we don't want to manage them. We want to really go into the big emotions.
Army vet Mike Keppert is playing Othello, a character known for big, uncontrolled emotions like jealousy and rage. He says that feeling all of that in a safe way is a good thing.
It's not like I don't know the consequences already, but it is interesting to see them play out so, I don't know, irrevocably. Like, you know, he ends up killing the one woman that he loves, you know, and you can't take that back, you know. So it's not to say that I felt anything close to that. It's just interesting to see that if someone does not address certain things, how far they can progress.
And Navy vet Ronnie Graham, who plays Cassio, says he's proud of his fellow actors.
I see the growth. That's what I enjoy the most, is seeing guys that really, you know, they struggle. You know, I mean, theater's not easy, especially Shakespeare. You know, it's intimidating to begin with. I mean, you think of Shakespeare, you think of these so educated people that are speaking they and thou, and you have no idea what they're saying. But in order to tackle that is... it's amazing. I see guys just really put forth the effort. You just admire that, and I love seeing growth.
A pleasure. Me, a sport. Traverse, go! Provide thy money. We will have more of this tomorrow.
Back in the rehearsal room, the scene blocking continues. The show opens in a couple of weeks, and there's a lot of work to do. Nancy Smith Watson says she hopes a lot of non-veterans will attend the group's performances.
Well, I do think that most people want to take care of our veterans, but I think a lot of people just don't know how to talk to them. They're afraid of saying something wrong. They don't know what they should ask. Doing the full productions allows us to really bring them into the room with a lot of civilians.
And for all of the veterans that I spoke to, the thrill of saying aloud those glorious words of Shakespeare is mixed with something far more practical.
You take your emotions out of your duffel bag, you get to play with them. At the end of the day, you put them back away, you know where that they are, and you've done something with it, so your bag's a little bit lighter at the end of the day.
Night and hell must bring this monstrous birth to the world's light.
For Lake Effect, I'm Bonnie North.
You can find photos and links to more about the Feast of Crispian and this production of Othello, which opens tonight at Next Act Theater in the Third Ward. Find those links at WUWM.com.
Finally today, we have time to listen to a recording from a recent session in the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
Milwaukee musician and occasional Lake Effect contributor Mike Mangione has a new album out with his band The Kin, featuring his brother Tom and the string duo of Monique and Shantae Ross, known as Sista Strings.
We'll feature an interview with the band in the coming days, but here's just a taste. A song from the new album called But I've Seen the Stars. It's a song called Nothing Lasts Forever.
numb can words remain? How numb can feelings fall when beloved is a muse no man can escape at all? I feel your distant fever, and at times I hear your plea, and I taste my tongue burn from every promise gone selfishly. Before you leave me, mother, please help me understand how a boy can be a lover, how a lover can be a man. And if you want me, babe, please want me here today, because nothing lasts forever and nothing's here to stay. So many seem the mornings, now one less until I go, but no beauty of a sunrise can fulfill that ache that we almost know. I know I acted foolish, I was a thief among family, but no fault to bleach, desire can redeem eternity. And I know so well forgiveness, I know so well regret. Every time they pierce my heart, well, it feels like they've never met. If you want me, babe, please want me here today, because nothing lasts forever, nothing's here to stay.
Mike Mangione and the Kin playing Nothing Lasts Forever in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.
Because nothing lasts forever but the love. Woman.